And now to that bitter cold seizing up the mid-country like an old engine. Minneapolis public schools will be closed through tomorrow. Some schools in Chicago, Iowa, and Michigan also closed. In Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers has declared a state of emergency after more than a foot of snow fell in parts of that state. And tomorrow it's expected to be 17 degrees below zero, which will feel like minus 46 degrees with the wind chill. Some of the other temperatures, wind chills in northern Illinois could fall to minus 55. In Minnesota, there will be minus 30 with a wind chill of minus 60. So it will be cold outside and a lot of people trying to bring people inside. Matt Johnson is executive director of the Day-by-Day Warming Shelter in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Matt, this week you've upped your hours, not just open during the night, but now during the day. What are you seeing there?
Yes, it is bitter cold here in Winnebago County and throughout Wisconsin this week. Right now we're looking at the lows, including wind chill, to be below negative 20 or negative 30 this evening.
Yeah,
and throughout the rest of the week.
Right. So you've expanded your services this week. First, tell us what you are. It's called a last stop shelter. What does that mean?
So we're a last resort shelter. So that means any individual, regardless of criminal background or drug and alcohol usage or any history whatsoever, is allowed to stay at our shelter. For many individuals within Winnebago County, we are the only option that they have for emergency shelter services. Our shelter takes in about 25 individuals each evening for 6 months out of the year. From a 2016 census, in our county, we have about 200 homeless individuals. So for 25 people each evening, we're the only option for support for them.
Well, and to remind people, you don't take children, and some centers that do will not let people with criminal backgrounds or abuse issues in. So this is their last resort. What will people get there?
So at our shelter, we do offer a warm bed and a warm meal, but we try to expand off of those traditional service options and also provide resource coordination. So with the help of our operations manager, each individual has the opportunity to seek resources like permanent housing, like employment, like mental health or addiction services. Any of those other options and supportive services are made available to them, and we try to refer those individuals to partnering organizations in Oshkosh and throughout our county services.
Look, you know what we're hearing about this cold snap that's coming, and we're hearing it's because a blast of warm air from misplaced Moroccan heat last month made the, you know, usually super chilly air temperatures above the North Pole warm up, and that split the polar vortex into pieces, and those pieces started to wander, and one is headed your way. That's not going to mean that much to people who are out on the street struggling with other issues and trying to get in. In fact, they may not even hear about this. What does the city do to let the homeless people know we're serious this time?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to get information out and about is let them know that we are trying to work as best as we can, not only as a city, not only as an organization, but as a community, to try to make sure that their needs are met as much as possible this week. Mm-hmm. So we met with the fire chief, and because we knew that this cold was coming, we had a temporary lift in our permit to allow more individuals to be there, to be open 24 hours a day for this week, and to make sure that any individual seeking those services was able to be here. So working with those partners, we're able to make that happen.
Well, you're joining people across the region. You know, emergency crews are being told every call is possibly life-threatening. You know, somebody freezing to death. The Chicago Zoological Society said it's closing the Brookfield Zoo tomorrow, when it's supposed to be the worst, and Thursday, to protect both the workers and the animals. And here you're trying to protect people. But, you know, traditionally, many homeless people with issues don't want to come in. Can you force someone in?
We cannot, no. But we try to, as best as possible, educate individuals that could use those services about the benefits of seeking support. We have initiatives throughout the year, including our county's point in time count, to where we try to identify those individuals, get information out, and provide connections to partnering organizations other service models that can provide some of those additional services, like you're talking about, mental health, addiction services, domestic violence, trauma, anything like that to help end that cycle of impoverishment for these individuals.
Well, and as you say, to have a network before a day like this hits, so you have a plan. Matt Johnson, Executive Director of the Day by Day Warming Shelter in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Matt, best of luck to you.
Thank you, and thanks for having us on.
Well, today in London, Prime Minister Theresa May is taking another crack at getting Parliament to agree to her deal for Britain to exit the European Union. 2 weeks ago today, lawmakers defeated her plan. Now she's trying to get them to amend it and hopes to get the EU to approve the changes. Here she is speaking today in the House of Commons.
If you want to tell Brussels what this House will accept, you have to vote for it. If you want to leave with a deal, you have to vote for it. If you want Brexit, you have to vote for Brexit.
Yeah. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. He's at Westminster. Rob, this is a bit confusing since Parliament already rejected the Prime Minister's plan. What exactly is happening today?
Well, you know, I often say, Jeremy, I've probably used this one on you before, that if you're not confused about Brexit, it means you're not following it closely enough.
Exactly.
But we have a real doozy of a development. I mean, to be serious, I mean, it's quite astonishing the events in London in the last few hours. I mean, essentially, with 60 days to go until Brexit Day, Theresa May has said, what, that she's going to try to renegotiate Britain's withdrawal treaty, something that until very recently she said was out of the question. It was impossible. She told MPs it couldn't be done. And now she's going back to do it. And, you know, the adjectives come to mind, such as sort of desperate, cynical. It's an attempt to try and keep a governing Conservative Party together. But an awful lot of people are thinking to themselves, well, she's betting the farm on the EU being willing to make compromises to avoid a no deal. But is it a bet well placed?
Well, and it seems like what she's trying to do is to win over some of the hardcore Brexiteers to get just enough of them on board to get her plan through. Is that right?
That is right. I mean, look, she's betting on two things happening. She's betting that the European Union, in order to try and avoid a no deal and all the economic consequences of that, might be prepared to make some tweaks to the arrangement about how you avoid having a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland because of the history of violence. Nobody wants that. And I think she's also hoping that those, as you say, on the sort of right of her party, the Brexit enthusiasts, you know, will, as the clock ticks down, be willing to accept any compromise that EU makes. But we'll see. I mean, of course, another view of all of this, Jeremy, is that Theresa May is profoundly cynical, that she knows that the EU will send her away with a flea in her ear, and all she's doing is just running down the clock more in order to hope that MPs will eventually, in sheer desperation, get behind her unloved deal.
Now, when her deal failed before, we've been talking in the last couple of weeks about some of the push by some on the other side of the political aisle in the UK to have a second referendum. Is that going anywhere at this point, or now do they have to wait and watch what happens with this first?
It's more to wait and watch happens with that first, because I think the view in amongst those who want a second referendum is things have just got to get even worse than they are now. Now, I know everybody listening is going to think, hang on a minute, Rob, are you crazy? What do you mean worse than it is now? But I think their view is that everything else will have to be exhausted. You get my point, Jeremy, that, you know, she would need to try and go to the EU again. People might need to try and think about a softer version of Brexit, delaying Brexit, that everything else has to be tried before you eventually say, you know what, it would be really nasty having to have another referendum, but hey, we've run out of other options.
How is the opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party responding to what's happening today?
His critics would say badly, that you know, he's just not sort of suited to this, either in terms of sort of personality or in terms of policy, that he too is he's not one of the most he's not one of the most sort of witty, articulate performers in Parliament, but that perhaps just as more broadly, like Theresa May, you know, he has a problem in his party, and that, you know, 2/3 of Labour voters desperately want Britain to remain in the European Union, and about 1/3 of them really want Britain to leave, and Jeremy Corbyn is probably one of them, as someone of the Eurosceptic far left.
So here we are, Rob. We're now about 2 months away from the deadline for the UK to leave the EU unless they figure out whatever is going to happen. What's your prediction today?
That's an easy one to answer because I have absolutely no idea. But I will offer you this. I will offer you this from a man called Kenneth Clark, and he's what's known, he has that quaint title in British politics, the father of the House. It just means that he's the longest-serving MP, and he's a very colourful conservative, a very clever, eloquent man. And he just gave a speech where he said it was perfectly obvious we are in a state, I paraphrase a bit, of such absolute chaos here in the UK. We are never going to be ready to leave the European Union in 60 days. He's a wise old bird, Kenneth Clark, and if I was you and everybody else listening, I certainly wouldn't bet against delay of some sort.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, in London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
We spoke with Kenneth Clark when we were in London in the fall, and I remember what he said at the end. Pleasure.
Pleasure.
Earlier this month, a Kentucky teacher was charged with assault after a video camera at her school showed her dragging a 9-year-old boy with autism through the school hallways. The child had also been diagnosed with ADHD, PTSD, anxiety, and depression. His mother told a local news, teachers are supposed to stop the bullying, not be the bullies. But at least 10 studies show that while students with disabilities are more likely to be bullied than their peers without disabilities, some of that bullying does come from adults. Online support forums for families navigating disabilities have featured articles and testimonials confirming that. And today, two parents who say they've experienced it. We found their story in the North Fork, Long Island patch. Lauren Robert de Malaise is a mother of two, including daughter Chloe, diagnosed with autism, language impairment, and ADHD. Lauren joins us from Stony Brook University on Long Island. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, Virginia Scudder. Her son, Lucas, 5, has a sensory disorder that causes patterned and repetitive behavior, as well as a fear of loud noises. And she's there with Lauren. Hi, Virginia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And so both of you have seen this, adults bullying children. It sounds, unbelievable. But why don't we start, Lauren, with some of the ways that Chloe's autism might make her behave at certain times. What are some of her behaviors?
A lot of her behaviors are brought on by noises, overstimulation, and it causes her to yell, cover her ears, stamp her feet, and to cry and really kind of act out emotionally.
Yeah. Is she doing this in the classroom?
She does have times right now of frustration and anxiety where she does act out.
Most people listening are probably saying, yes, I know a child like that. Autism is so common now. And kids are being mainstreamed for all the right reasons into classrooms so that they can have an education, but in many school systems so that kids can have a diversity in their classrooms and they can see children, who might be slightly different from themselves, all thought to be part of the learning process. But what's been happening? What are you noticing in adults?
Parents didn't think that she belonged there. She was a distraction and a disturbance, and it ruined their child's day, and at some points demanded that she be removed from the classroom, although the teacher, said that Chloe should stay and remain with her peers. And they would talk about her, in the parking lot, and, she was a topic of conversation.
Oh. Look, Virginia, we know your son does not have autism, but he does have what sounds like some of the same kind of sensory disorders, maybe screaming when he hears a loud noise. What does Lucas display?
He's deathly afraid of sirens. He has difficulty with fine motor skills. He just has a difficult time transitioning. And so if things are not familiar, they're very foreign to him. The unusual or the not the norm definitely sets him off. And he does start crying. He panics. He'll hold his ear. It's a coping mechanism for him in dealing with his fear. And most recently, our shopping days are usually, set aside for Sundays as a family. And we went out. My husband took one twin. I took the other and my daughter. I had Lucas, and we were just wiping down the cart. It had rained. He was crying from it being wet, and he was crying from the loud noises coming from the bakery. They had the radio blasting, and he was holding his ears and crying and shouting that he wanted to go. And we had a complete and utter stranger just shout out, shut up. Mm. And of course, he used other foul language. It shouldn't have to get to the point where I have to turn to someone I completely don't know, a complete and utter stranger, and say, my son has sensory processing issues, and have to have a discussion with a stranger about it. Mm. Now, mind you, this person had no desire to have that conversation, and nor would I have given him that at that point, because it had it really did escalate.
Well, a couple thoughts. Parents trying to wrangle kids. A lot of kids have just meltdowns, and it doesn't help to have a stranger, you know, when you're overloaded anyway, with any kid. Lauren, I want to go back to Chloe. It seems like in addition to parents just kind of clucking about whether or not she's disturbing the class, there was a bus driver who was almost threatening.
Yes, she loved going on the bus, and it was exciting for her. And the route changed, and they changed the bus driver. And there was an immediate change in her behavior, and she would come home screaming and crying. And she has a language delay when it comes to talking about feelings and emotions. So I was not able to really get much information, you know, out of her, other than we noticed this major change in behavior. The bus driver did make some inappropriate comments in front of me when I was getting her off the bus. You know, I did go in and speak with the teacher, and I did have a report written that said that, you know, as of the date that she started with this new bus driver, that her behavior in class had changed. And another teacher was told by this bus driver, get her off my bus, she's your problem now. And I was able to finally get Chloe to open up. She told me that, you know, the bus driver had told her to zip it, would scream at her from the driver's seat. And when I did bring this up to, you know, to the teachers, they investigated, and it was confirmed by the bus matron. And eventually, you know, there was a new bus driver that was assigned, and Chloe's behavior immediately changed. Mm. But this was going on for months before I was able to actually figure it out.
It's probably heartbreaking to hear. But mm-hmm. I have to ask you both, what do you say to a bus driver or a teacher who might say, you know, I have so much to handle in a class. I can't also handle a child who might be frightened of noises or might in some way disrupt the class. Or to a parent who might say, I have sympathy, but I'm worried that she's going to disrupt the class and stop my child's learning.
You know, I absolutely could see and understand that side to the story, but I do feel that there are certain inappropriate ways to handling situations such as those. Maybe there's another class that might be more appropriate for that child with a teacher that is skilled to take care of a child who has those needs. And, you know, we don't want any child to have their education interrupted. But, you know, it is a learning lesson that life does have interruptions. And mm-hmm. we have to learn how to cope with them, even as a typical child. And that teachers and parents should work together to make sure that the education and well-being of every single child is on the forefront, not just one child over another.
I'm wondering, Virginia, do you think it would benefit to have, before school starts, some sort of a, you know, a conference for parents and teachers to introduce them to the idea that there will be a child with whatever the issue is in the classroom, and here's what you can tell your child about this, to learn about it? You know, would that help?
Well, I'm actually in the field of education, and I am not only a mother, I'm a teacher, and I work in the public school system. I think part of the issue here is the school in which Chloe was enrolled in was a private school, and they don't always follow procedure. Unfortunately, in these types of private settings, you have individuals, and I like to call them the narcissistic bully. They're very self-centered. They feel like it's only their world and only their child that deserves to stand out. They don't understand empathy. They feel like they're protecting their child, but they don't understand what they're doing, in essence, is really hurting the other child that they're speaking of or that they're complaining about.
Well, are you worried that they're also maybe hurting their own child?
Of course. I mean, that's right. The bottom line with adult bullying and narcissistic bullying. You know, you don't have signs hanging from a child's neck saying, I'm autistic, I have Asperger's. I think the idea here is empathy. And unfortunately, no matter what situation or setting you're in, as an adult and as a parent, that should be the forefront, empathy. Mm-hmm. And you should be teaching that through your own words and how you behave in front of your child.
What we're talking about is adult bullying. But do you worry that that's soon going to translate to kids? I mean, both Chloe and Lucas seem to be thriving outside of these incidents. Do you worry that that's going to change as they get older and it'll be the kids bullying?
Absolutely. You know, I believe that this is cyclical. If you have a parent that is talking about another child or criticizing the way that a child is being parented, your children are listening. And we set examples with everything that we do. And when we set the example that this type of behavior is acceptable, then that child believes that it is acceptable. I also think that when we have people in the community that don't stick up for this child, we're setting an example that it's okay to behave this way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the one way to end bullying is by parents setting a good example that we do not treat people this way. We treat people with empathy and with kindness. We give people the benefit of the doubt, that we have open communication. But it's also that we stick up for what's right and we stand behind our word. And if we know this is going on and we do nothing to stop it, then we're just as guilty.
That's Lauren Robert Desmalais. She and Virginia Scudder have kids with neurological differences, and they are finding, disturbingly, that it's adults who are doing the bullying and even cutting off. Do I understand, Lauren, you've had some adult friends of your own who've cut you off because you have a child with autism?
That's correct. Actually, one of my closest friends was trying to get Chloe kicked out of the same preschool that her daughter went to and was complaining about her and didn't want her child around my daughter anymore, even though she knew that we were having evaluations for autism done, and would talk about her behind my back.
That's tough. Well, I'm glad you have each other. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So, have you experienced adult bullying of a child with disabilities? Maybe even of a child without disabilities? Or do you think there is a better way to integrate children with challenges into schools? Your thoughts welcome. HereAndNow.org.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
The United States laid out its case against Chinese telecom giant Huawei and its chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, this week, nearly 2 months after Meng was arrested in Vancouver. Meng and her company stand accused of trying to evade sanctions on Iran, stealing trade secrets from T-Mobile, and trying to obstruct a criminal investigation. China says the indictments are unfair and immoral. And oh, by the way, the U.S. and China meet for trade negotiations tomorrow in Washington. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
Let's first of all talk about these charges that the U.S. has now filed.
Well, so it's a 13-count indictment, and it says that Huawei and two affiliated companies and the chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, engaged in bank fraud, wire fraud, conspiracy having to do with business that it does in Iran, which the United States alleges is contrary to the sanctions that are imposed on Iran. According to the indictment, this deception goes all the way back to 2007 when Huawei's founder, who's the father of Meng Wanzhou, falsely told the FBI the company didn't violate any U.S. export laws and had not dealt directly with any Iranian company. Now, separately, there were charges filed in Washington state that accused the company of selling trade secrets from T-Mobile and offering bonuses to employees who succeeded in getting technology from rivals.
And the U.S. is making the case that Huawei is a dual threat to both U.S. economic and national security. Now, as we said, this comes as the two countries are meeting about trade and they're in the midst of a trade war. Is it connected?
It seems to be connected. Let's put it that way. There are a few concerns. Obviously, the Iran ban, that feels a little more political. But the idea that trade secrets are being taken from an American company is central to why the United States wanted to get into a trade discussion with China in the first place. It's actually the part that most people agree upon, that there's definitely a problem with that. As we move into 5G, you know, that allows gadgets to sort of communicate with millions of antennas and cars talking to each other and all of that kind of stuff. So there's a security issue as well. There's a lot of concern that if China controls as much of the industry as China does and Huawei does, that that's a national security issue. And that was actually part of some hearings that were going on Capitol Hill today. So it's a bit of both.
I want to ask you about one other big international story that is playing out in the world of business today, and that has to do with Venezuela. New sanctions on the state-owned oil company there, Petróleos de Venezuela. Now, the U.S. subsidiary of that is Citgo,
correct,
which everybody knows. And what President Maduro in Venezuela is saying is that these sanctions are an attempt by the U.S. to steal Citgo from Venezuelans. Tell us more about what we know here.
Yeah, so the as you know, we have an issue in which sort of an opposition leader has been recognized as the leader of Venezuela by a number of other countries, including the United States, but Maduro is not leaving. So the United States is now putting pressure on Maduro by sort of starving his main line of income, which is this oil company. So the U.S. is expecting to block $7 billion in assets and to result in $11 billion in export losses to force Maduro out. The reason the U.S. hadn't done this already is because they didn't have a hand to force. Mm-hmm. Now that there's somebody else that they're supporting as the National Assembly leader, as the president, the U.S. wants to use this to force Venezuela into a corner and to have people turn against Maduro.
We'll keep watching that story. It just keeps developing by the day. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks as always.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Miami blue butterfly has had a difficult life. Once they were common all over South Florida, now they're only found on a few islands in the Keys. WLRN's Nancy Klinger found that biologists are trying to bring them back.
Biologists call the Miami blue the Rasputin of butterflies, like the Russian mystic who survived numerous assassination attempts before he was eventually done in. They're hoping for a happier ending for the Miami blue. By the early 1990s, only one colony existed on Key Biscayne. Then Hurricane Andrew came through in 1992, and it disappeared. People thought they were extinct. 7 years later, Miami blues were spotted in a state park in the Lower Keys. Then that colony disappeared. But the butterflies had been found again, living on some wildlife refuge islands near Key West.
Come on, you got one more. There we go. I think, there's still one in there. Hey. Wrong way, Joe.
These Miami blue butterflies were bred in a lab. Now Kim Gable, a volunteer, is coaxing them to try out life in the wild.
Oh, there you go. I think we got them all.
These are newborn butterflies, but they've had pretty adventurous lives so far. They started out in the lab at the University of Florida in Gainesville as caterpillars. When they became pupae, they got shipped by FedEx to the Keys. They emerged as butterflies in Sarah Steele Cabrera's office on Big Pine Key, then a car ride to Long Key State Park.
These guys are wanting to get in the sun.
Cabrera is a University of Florida graduate student who runs the Miami Blue Project in the Keys.
Oh, see, this one's already trying to mate. You see there it's curving its abdomen? And they haven't been in temperatures this warm yet in their short lives.
They're
so
ready to go.
They're raring to go.
They don't have long. The Miami Blue's lifespan is about a month. That includes its time as an egg, a caterpillar, and a pupa. As an adult butterfly, it gets from a few days to a week.
It's enough time for them to come out, fly around, find a mate, lay eggs, and die.
If they're lucky. Everything wants to eat them. Wasps, lizards, birds.
You know, they're just a tasty little morsel for any other animal, basically.
Except, it turns out, for carpenter ants. They feed off a sugar liquid that Miami blue caterpillars produce, and they protect the future butterflies.
And they're large and fairly aggressive ants, and if they have a caterpillar that they're tending, they do not leave that caterpillar, and they're just walking back and forth patrolling, and if they find another insect nearby, they will pick it up and throw it off the plant.
The rediscovery of the Miami blue was a huge deal for people who are fans of this insect. There's a Butterfly Watchers chapter named for them. Its members lobbied hard for state and federal protection. But it's not an especially impressive specimen.
Yeah, you talk about a blue butterfly, most people think of like a blue morpho, like in Central America. So they get in their head that they're these huge, giant, bright blue butterflies.
The Miami blue is about the size of a thumbnail, and it doesn't even look blue unless it opens its wings.
They're just little teeny guys that flit around and occasionally show you the blue.
They don't fly that far.
Taylor Hunt is one of the researchers who returns to the release area to see if the butterflies have survived or better yet, reproduced.
Like, they're not going to fly a half mile. They're not going to fly a quarter mile. You know, they're small butterflies. They're not going to fly in this wind. They're going to stay localized to this area.
Miami blues used to be found along large swaths of coastal South Florida, from Sarasota through the Keys up to Cape Canaveral.
I have an old butterfly guide from 1954, and they were listed as common, so common that nobody really ever gave them a second thought.
But the host plants where they lay their eggs are only found in coastal areas, the waterfronts that saw lots of development in the 80s and 90s.
When they disappeared, what they were telling us is that there just wasn't enough of their coastal habitat left. If there isn't healthy, wild beach berm habitat, there more than likely will not be Miami blue butterflies.
For now, the only wild population left is on a few islands to the west of Key West.
Depending on the day, between the hundreds or thousands when there should be millions of them across the state.
This is the fourth time Cabrera has released Miami blue butterflies at Long Key State Park, and the first time she's releasing adults. She says Miami blues could thrive where people live, as long as they have the plants where they lay eggs, the plants that provide the nectar they eat, and they are not regularly sprayed with insecticides. For Here and Now, I'm Nancy Klinginer.
Well, I'm sure it's not easy to hear this if you live in the Midwest, but the polar vortex might be a good thing for the region's forests because it could wipe out a portion of the emerald ash borer. Here to explain is Lee Frelick, director of the University of Minnesota's Center for Forest Ecology. He's in St. Paul. Lee, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
And first of all, you're right there where the polar vortex is coming in. What is it like there at the moment?
Well, there's kind of frizzy clouds. I'm not sure that the true polar air is here yet because I would expect it to be clear. It's maybe 9 or 10 below zero, and we expect temperatures to fall throughout the day and maybe hit somewhere around 30 below zero tonight.
So for a lot of people, that is not a good thing. It's going to be pretty uncomfortable and even dangerous for some. But you point out that it could actually be good news for dealing with an invasive species. Tell us about the emerald ash borer. What is it?
Yeah, the emerald ash borer is an insect from Asia that infests and kills ash trees. White ash, black ash, and green ash are pretty abundant all across the northeastern United States, from Maine all the way to Minnesota. And it was introduced into Michigan first and quite a while ago, 10 or 15 years ago, and it's been spreading in all directions from there. So it reached us several years ago here in the Twin Cities, I think in 2011 or 2012, and then we had a cold spell in 2013, 2014. That winter we had also a polar vortex event, and that set it back for a few years, but it recovered and it's killed many millions of trees.
And it thrives on warmer temperatures, and there have been generally warmer temperatures.
Yes, in general, winters have been fairly mild, but if you can get it down to 30 below zero or colder under the bark, and you have to remember the bark of trees is a really good insulator, mm-hmm. so it has to actually get colder for the air temperature in order to make it cold enough to kill the bugs under the bark.
And you think that'll help in the long run to save some of these ash trees?
Yeah, it'll slow the spread of the insect. But what we're worried about are the trees out in the forest where nobody's going to treat them. So in Minnesota, we have part of the state where it gets down to 30 below zero or colder every winter, and that's to the north of us in St. Paul here, so the northern part of Minnesota. And the question is, when will the warming climate get warm enough that it no longer gets down to 30 below zero there? Because we have vast black ash swamps, which are actually really beautiful, and they have huge diversity of plants and are great wildlife habitat. And almost a billion ash trees live in those swamps. So they're safe right now, but in the future that might not happen.
Now, aside from the emerald ash borer, there are some other effects of warmer winters not being able to kill the larvae of other invasive species. There are pine beetles in the western U.S., ticks that carry Lyme disease, the winter tick that's making moose sick in Maine. Do you think that these cold temperatures are going to have effects on some of these other invasive species?
Yes, I think they will. Very cold winter temperatures have actually quite a few positive effects in terms of killing off insect pests in particular. Mountain pine beetle, it has a winter minimum lethal threshold around minus 40. And currently it's in Canada, it's in Alberta. And from here, of course, there's contiguous forest in the north all the way out to Maine, so it would be able to infest our jack pine, white pine, and red pine, which are our three species of pine in the northern United States.
Well, I was reading in the Chicago Tribune that the polar bears are going to like this cold weather at the zoo there in Chicago. So I guess it depends on depends on the species, whether they like it or whether they don't.
Yeah, polar bears definitely should be happy, although I hear that it's actually warmer in parts of the Arctic than it is here.
Yeah.
So maybe not the best news for polar bears up there.
That is Lee Frelich, who's director of the University of Minnesota Center for Forest Ecology. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
After all the bruising headlines involving Facebook lately, here's one the company can celebrate. It's expected to post record profits when the company publishes quarterly earnings tomorrow. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is Recode's senior editor for social media. He joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Robin.
And we have spoken about Facebook's troubles. They're expecting a record fine from the FTC over privacy violations relating to the Cambridge Analytica scandal. This is the Steve Bannon-backed political consulting firm that drained Facebook users' personal data. Turns out Facebook knew long before they said they did. Then there was that story about Facebook's political activity trying to cover up their company's role in the Russia scandal by hiring a firm to throw shade at the Democrat George Soros. You know, we're always hearing about users leaving the service, and yet they're expected to post record profits. What's going on?
It doesn't seem to align, does it?
No.
You know, one thing to remember is that Facebook will be reporting its Q4 earnings tomorrow. And Q4 is typically the largest and biggest best quarter for advertising businesses because all of the marketers spend money around the holidays. So part of this is just the timing. Facebook always has a strong Q4. And so people are expecting that to happen again. But I think also, despite all of the bad publicity that Facebook's gone, all of the missteps that the company has had, we really haven't seen a lot of advertisers or users actually leave the platform. We've seen some growth slow down, especially in the United States, but Facebook is still growing in other parts of the world. And most importantly, I don't think a lot of advertisers have stopped using Facebook. Mm-hmm. So the business is still doing pretty good.
Well, and just remind people how it works, those who aren't familiar with Facebook, because you don't pay to go on Facebook, but there's the revenue that comes from advertising. And we understand mobile advertising in particular is going up.
Oh, yeah. Facebook is a free service for users, which means that someone else is paying the bill. In this case, Facebook makes its money, almost all of it, through advertising, and it shows those users targeted ads into their feed, into the app. And most of that money now comes from mobile devices. A few years ago, Facebook made this big shift. The company likes to talk about it as around 2012, 2013, where they switched kind of everything over to mobile. And since then, the mobile business has just absolutely boomed. I mean, think about how much you probably use your phone and how much you probably use these apps versus using them maybe on a laptop. So most of the business is on the phone as well.
Right. And it's, as you point out, it's staying. So that's where they get their revenue. But Facebook has, staying with ads, Facebook has been so criticized for allowing or even facilitating the spread of fake news, sometimes through ads in elections, the US, UK. And last year, because of that, it debuted its publicly searchable library of all political ads. They wanted to be more transparent. Now they're rolling out versions of that political ad archive for international markets ahead of elections coming up, Europe, India, Ukraine, Israel. Has that made any difference? I mean, do you know, are people looking to see what's true?
It's hard to quantify the difference that that's made. I think actually a lot of the changes Facebook has made to try and protect itself against any kind of election integrity issues have been hard to measure. I think what this does is it adds another layer of difficulty for, you know, a bad actor or someone who's out there that wants to try and pretend to be one person as an advertiser on Facebook, but is really someone else. It just makes that harder because now Facebook's actually paying attention and tracking and labeling all of these ads and making them available to outside organizations that might want to audit Facebook for this. So I'm not sure that it's actually made a significant change, but you know, the 2018 midterms came and went, and we didn't really learn anything at the time of a similar campaign to like what we saw in 2016. So maybe this stuff is starting to help a little bit.
Well, and what is something like Facebook? Maybe a silly question, but what do they pay more attention to? Because they're expected to have these great earnings, you know, revenue up, but their stocks keep plummeting, you know, periodically with these devastating stories. Do they care?
About the stock?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's one of their mostly, you know, Mark Zuckerberg at this point is so wealthy that I'm not sure that a stock change in one way or the other is really causing him to lose sleep. But I think it's more the employees and the recruiting efforts, right? If you're Facebook and you're competing against Google and Apple and Amazon and Netflix to try and woo the best tech talent in the world, you want to be able to show, hey, if you come here, you know, this is a company that's on the rise and we're going to give you stock options that are going to increase in value. And when you, you know, leave here in 5 years or whatever it may be, you've made a nice pretty penny. And that goes a long way for employees. And morale at these companies. So they definitely care about the stock price because it impacts their competitive landscape.
Yeah, just very briefly, we only have a few seconds. Last week we saw some media layoffs, BuzzFeed, The Huffington Post, Gannett, and some Democratic members of Congress, I'm thinking of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, are laying the blame on Facebook and Google. How?
Well, Facebook and Google have totally changed the whole ad industry, and they've, you know, taken a lot of the content that these media publishers create and disseminated it, but taken a lot of the money that comes with it. And so it's essentially put a lot of these media companies in a tough spot where they're creating all the stuff, they're not getting the money in exchange for it.
Yeah. Kurt Wagner, senior editor for social media at Recode. Kurt, thanks as always.
Yep. Thank you, Robin.
Heard Him Here and Now, which is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.